Today we're going to talk about the social nature of mind, how people work together, collaborating to build up who they are, what their relationships are, what their skills are. This starts from very early in life, from the very beginning at birth. As children develop, they work with their parents, especially their mother in most cases, and build up social roles, social interactions, their mind, many aspects of their mind, together with other people. In doing this, they construct a range of skills. The collaboration with others is really important in the range that people show in what they can do. They gradually co-construct complicated identity, complicated selves, complicated understanding of other people. So that's what we're going to focus on today. In general, the mind is filled with other people. It's filled with what we call agencies, as I'm illustrating here. The mind is active, and these agencies in the mind are active. They're based in the real relationships that we have, especially in our families and with our close friends and our community. And they're based in not only what's happening to us now in their relationships, but what happened to us earlier in their lives. And much of the organization of our mind, many of the agencies of our mind, all of them really, function unconsciously, even more than consciously. So a lot of what goes on, we're not really aware of, although they are based in our real relationships. So the mind, you can say, is fundamentally social, relational, composed of these important agents, and you can see this from the very beginning in infancy when certain themes emerge. Eye-to-eye contact and imitation are two of them that I'll talk about. Eye-to-eye contact has a special relational significance, whether you're old guys like Piaget and Bebel Inhelder here looking into each other's eyes. They were very close collaborators and good friends. Or whether you're a baby looking into his mom's eyes. His mom's taking the picture. That's actually my son Seth looking at his mother. And greeting her. You see this. It's not just the eyes. There's a whole reaction that happens, as you can see in his face as he's greeting her with the, he's actually saying, ooh, while he's making that face. Imitation is another example besides eye-to-eye contact. We often think about imitation as if it's only for learning, but it's really essentially for a kind of sharing and connecting with other people, not just for learning. This is really obvious in young children. If you want to get close to a two-year-old, one of the best ways to do it is to start imitating them. So as they're leaning over and grabbing a toy, you lean over and grab the toy. As they're making a certain sound, you make that sound. When I was first thinking about this, I was in a furniture store, and there was this miserable two-year-old walking around who whose parents were busy looking at furniture, not paying attention to him. So I started just imitating him, and it took him about 2 minutes to be over pulling on my legs, wanting to play with me. It's a kind of natural way of engaging little kids. Now, a few years older, if you imitate them so directly, they say, "Stop copying me." But at this early age, it's a really direct way of engaging. And as we become older, we develop kind of more sophisticated forms of this sharing and connecting through imitation. So instead of directly imitating somebody, which is seen as kind of insulting sometimes if you're an older kid or an adult, you do it more indirectly. So when they sit in a certain posture, you sit in the same posture. When they use a certain kind of a sentence structure, you use the same sentence structure. Now, you don't know you're doing this, but when you want to be close to somebody, you naturally try to match what they're doing in order to connect to them, and they resonate to your matching. It's the same thing with just sharing experiences and beliefs. That I know many of you have, probably everybody has experienced a time when you're trying to be close to somebody, you're making a new friend, you're falling in love, whatever your you're building connection. And one of the things you do is you talk about the things that you share all the time. Oh, you thought that part of the play was funny. Well, I had left it exactly the same place. Right? You really love this popular song. I really love it too. And of course, there are going to be many disagreements in any adults, many things that you don't share, but you don't focus on those. You emphasize the positive to the point sometimes that you might drive your friends crazy saying, oh, he and I are exactly the same. She and I are exactly the same. That's part of this whole process of imitative sharing, connecting, which begins very early in infancy through this basic imitation, sharing through imitation. So in general, imitation is for learning, but it's also for disconnecting, for this sharing. It illustrates really nicely how we are social from the very beginning and continue to be social through our lives, having the connections with others be central to what we do and who we are and how we learn. Now, parallel play is something that probably everybody has heard about. And this view of, in terms of imitation changes the way we think about parallel play. It's conventionally been thought about as involving two kids doing things independently and showing how they're not relating to each other, but really what it shows is that they're sharing through imitation. Just somehow there was myth through the first 50 years of work in this on this phenomenon. So when this little girl is building a tower of blocks like this little boy, she is directly connecting to him. She's saying, I want to relate to you. I have an image of an old story that I love from my first son. When he was in daycare, he had a best friend in his daycare named Nicole. And when she would usually get there before he would arrive to class, walk in, and she would immediately start following him around the room, copying him, imitating him, to get the connection going. It was just very striking when I was thinking about this and went to the classroom, to the home really, to the daycare center, and watched them, and he was connecting to her, she to him, through this imitation of each other every day. So in general, people grow together. Imitation and eye-to-eye contact are just two concrete examples of this. Naturally collaborating, especially in close relationships. When you look at mother-child or father-child or close caregiver and child, it can be a sibling, it can be an aunt, whatever, you see this very close connection really dramatically. And you see some specific phenomena in it, especially dramatically. Scaffolding is one of the best examples. Scaffolding is an example where one person, an adult like a mother, supports the activities of a less expert or novice person like a child, and does a task with the child so that the child can act in a more sophisticated way than they could otherwise. It's called scaffolding by analogy with building a house. This man is going to actually have trouble hammering the nail into the house if he's just there like that, because he's going to fall down. But if you put up a scaffold, then he can stand up high on the house and build. And an expert in social interaction, like a mother with a baby, can provide the same kind of support, so that the baby can function in a more complex, a higher level activity. So it's called scaffolding. In class, we will look at a film of mother and child interacting and do an analysis of how the scaffolding occurs and how the skill is built. The term scaffolding was actually originally introduced by David Wood, with Bruner and Ross, and he did his first work on it with a set of wooden blocks that fit together into a puzzle. You see that with these blocks here, they form a pyramid, and they're pretty complicated. Every block will fit well, really, with only one or two other blocks in the puzzle. First, you build up the lower level by putting together four blocks. They have little pegs and holes and raised places so that they can fit together. You build the lower level, then you build a higher level. They sit on top of that and gradually build up the whole pyramid. It's hard to do because of all these pegs and holes, and 3- and 4-year-olds love it. So when David Wood brought a bunch of mothers and preschoolers in to play with this puzzle, actually a bunch of them asked him if they could buy it because they were amazed that their child spent a whole hour sitting just playing with the puzzle, but it's never been commercially available. Most of the kids could not build the puzzle on their own. They expected their mother to provide the kind of scaffolding, helping them to figure out which particular piece to pick now and how to line it up with the other piece. In scaffolding, the mother does not do the task for the child. She does the task with the child. She helps the child to do the task so that the child's actually very much engaged in the activity. It's a collaboration, building the pyramid or whatever the task is. There are many activities where this goes on every day with the mother and child. In general, when a child is acting in a scaffolding situation, they're acting very sophisticated, like building that complicated puzzle of pyramids, something that they can't do if they're doing it by themselves. And more broadly, there's a range of skills or competences that children have that scaffolding is only one example of it. In that one, the adult is actually doing part of the test for the child. There's another phenomenon that's pretty well described, which involves high contextual support without scaffolding, where the expert or adult provides the support by priming what's key in the task. There are a number of ways of doing that. And then the child has to perform the task on her own, but she does it well when the priming is provided, and she does functions in a much lower level when the priming is not provided. So this is just a graph to try to illustrate how this works, where knowing and learning vary with contextual support as the child jointly constructs a skill or a performance. Here, when the mother is supporting the child, you have a high level of functioning. As soon as the support disappears, the child's performance drops to a lower level of skill. And then every time the support is provided, the performance jumps up again, and every time the support is not provided, the performance drops down again. So you have the same child, in a matter of a few minutes, functioning in a very sophisticated way, functioning in a much more primitive way, based on whether the partner, in our examples, the mother, is supporting the high level of skill. The upper level here is called the optimal level. That's the best the child can do with support. And the lower level is called the functional level. That's the best the child can do without support. When you put together scaffolding, optimal level, functional level, you begin to get an idea of the map of children's skills. Here's an example of the express example of social support. Here you've got a 2-year-old who needs to act out a doll named Jane acting as a mother. And there are two ways that she can provide this support without actually doing the task for the child. They're doing part of the task for the child as she would do in scaffolding. She could model the story, demonstrate Jane is a doll acting like a mother. Or she could tell the child, if the child's articulate and has good language, that the child's supposed to make the doll, hold her baby, give it milk, and say, "I love you, baby." Okay? And likewise, for acting out a child role, the adult could model showing a doll acting like a little girl named Johanna, where she could tell the child to have the doll play with her toy house, ride her tricycle, and say, "I love to play," or some other selection of child behaviors. Okay, so that's an example. There's a concrete example of social support without scaffolding. Now, you can on your own just try to think about what might be some examples of scaffolding in these situations as opposed to social support. How would the mother or interviewer interacting with the child scaffold the performance as opposed to merely supporting it in this way? So the whole range of performance goes from functional level of the best they can do without any help from somebody else, to optimal level, the best they can do with priming the key parts of the task or demonstrating the task, and scaffolding the best they can do when the person, expert person, is doing it with them. So the performance gets higher as you move down the chart. This is a demonstration of these concepts of the web. We've talked about the web already in the course. Kind of development occurs in a web, not a ladder. This is a web for two roles, mother role and a best friend role. We're focusing on social roles today. You have functional level here, optimal level here, and scaffolding level here. Vary some exactly where they are on each strand, but in general, you have functional level early, then the optimal level, then the functional, then the scaffolding level. Indicating a different level of competence or skill for the same child in the same kind of domain, like acting out stories about kids and moms. So in general then, children enter a role of social relationships, learn a network of social relationships, especially in their family, the people in those relationships support the child's development, and the child learns about relationships as well as lots of other things. So we're going to focus now on the kinds of relationships that children learn. Mother-child's obviously, probably the most basic one, though some people don't want to say that, I guess. But around the world, moms are usually the basic caregiver, or one of the two or three basic caregivers. Mom has that special emotional tone for most adults around the world, both positive and negative, because we're always ambivalent about people we love. Same with father-child. It's also very important. It varies some in its exact form from culture to culture, but all cultures have mothers and fathers and children and roles defined for them. So children are growing up in a triad in many families. Virtually all families have these, have kind of slots for roles like these, so the particulars do differ with particular families and different cultures. And the child is learning this set of relationships, including the emotions that go with these relationships. Now, of course, that's the family is only a piece of it. The child is in the family. But she is also in a neighborhood, in a community. We've talked about this before, how the child is part of a web of a concentric circle, a web of concentric circles, maybe, of more and more complicated relationships. But from the beginning, the family is the is the center. In the family, children are learning how to be children, how to be parents, how to be spouses, how to be siblings, and there are all kinds of emotions are associated with those role relationships, and all of them require a mutual participation. Social roles in general, you can't be a mother without a child, you can't be a child without a mother, you can't be a doctor without a patient, and so forth for all of the social roles. There's always this kind of mutuality in the role relationships where we act out reciprocal roles, have reciprocal feelings, support each other in reciprocal ways. And we can rework the relationships too, of course. When we fall in love for the first time as an adult, we usually build on the close relationships we've had before with our parents, with our siblings, with our best friends, but it changes a little bit, or sometimes a lot, as we rework it. And a whole lot of this is automatic, unconscious. Some of it we can make conscious, most of it, it just happens. And, you know, like when you fall in love, why did you fall in love with that person? It's often a mystery. You can study it and you can do scientific analysis of it. You can say things like, well, if they're more similar to you, if they lived closer to you, if they remind you of certain people you loved before, all of those things are positives, but for predicting it in an individual person, it's a challenge. Maybe somebody here could take that on for the future, trying to really understand how we resonate with a particular person to build a close relationship with them. The children in our culture, especially, some cultures this is much less true, develop things that we call transitional objects, where they take an object and they treat it like a person. They build a relationship with it. The most famous example in English language is probably Winnie the Pooh, where there used to be another one in Peanuts with a blanket, a transitional object blanket that, who was it, Linus, had to carry everywhere? And here it's Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh. The child treats this object as kind of part like a person, like they have a relationship with it, like they love it. They get very upset if they don't have it. It's a security blanket or a security bear. Interesting question, why do children need such objects? Why do they construct them? Certainly, at least it shows us is that having a close relationship with something familiar that you love and maybe loves you in a funny way, easier to think about with a bear than a blanket. But that's an important part of your security as a child. So we're going to do a whole lot of examples in the class. We've already done some of social role development. It's one of the fundamental parts of being human is to understand social roles, and it's a great example with lots of research to support it of how development occurs, moving through skill levels, moving varying across functional, optimal, and scaffolded levels. We're going to focus today on roles about the family for obvious reasons. The studies involve many different methods, modeling and imitation, spontaneous stories, interviews, social interactions. And in general, the levels that we're going to talk about are similar to the ones we talked about earlier in the class about nice and mean and that you've been reading about. This is Tanya. She's two. She's having her kangaroo go potty. This kind of pretend situation is a perfect situation for looking at children's understanding of relationships and their emotions and a lot of other things. You don't want to kind of manipulate children to study them, so you want to find a situation in which they naturally are acting out or acting in terms of roles and emotions. And pretend plays are a really perfect situation for doing that. Show them love to do it, and they readily show you how they understand, how they feel about things in their world. So in families in general, as we're building up these roles, we're building general models of relationships. Who are we? Who are our loved ones? How should we act? How should they act? What should we strive for? What are our goals? What are our values? There are, of course, many different kinds of families, and we know the most about the conventional Western nuclear family, mother, father, children, maybe grandmother, grandfather, aunts, uncles, cousins. We need to know much more about other kinds of families. We're going to talk mostly in terms of this conventional Western family because that's where the research has been. Now, I said agencies, people of the mind. Before I had dancing couple. Well, really, a lot of the agencies are around the family. Most of us have our mother, our father, our siblings, our children, if we have them, in our minds. They're a part of us, whether they're there or not. My parents have been dead for several years. They're still there. And that's true for everyone, that the significant early relationships we have remain with us as part of ourselves, and they very much include emotions. They're not just cool roles, like some scientists understanding what a mother is without how a mother feels. The first real understanding of roles in the family with some depth and flexibility develops at about 2 to 3 years. I say that it's in pretend play and then language and in social interactions when children can represent Jane as my mother, I'm a child named Johanna. You see that in stories like the ones we've been talking about and in these many other parts of what the child does and feels. So you see the roles being played with and moved around in pretend and in fantasy, as in that Johanna, who's only three, becomes mommy. Here are some great photographs from compliments of Hannes Papacek, a Czech psychiatrist, of his daughter Tanya dressing up in mommy's bathing suit, playing a mommy role, and dressing, pretending to shave, playing a daddy role. Children don't just play the role of their own gender. They play around with all the roles. These roles move through a cycle of four levels of development, four levels that we see across all the domains on independent strands in developmental webs. So you have first a single representation that moves into a mapping, then a system of representations, and finally a system of representations which creates a single abstraction. This, the example we just talked about with Johanna being a child or a mom and Jane being a mom is down here with the single representations, the first of these levels in this cycle of four levels of development of representation. Notice that all of the higher levels subsume lower levels, and before these representations first emerge, there are a whole series of actions, sensory motor skills, that children develop through that provide the foundation for the representations. You've read about some of those, you'll read some more about them, and we'll talk about them later in the semester. Also notice that for every level, there is a set of emotions that go with it. For every role, there's a set of emotions that go with it. Here we have a single representation represented in a little more complex way as a block, which involves an agent, somebody doing something, acting out a behavioral role, like mother or child. these agents are often imbued with fear or anger or love or playfulness or other kinds of emotions. Of course, alligators are one of, along with sharks and dinosaurs, kind of prototypic representations of fear. But the fear isn't only of fantasy creatures or wild animals, it's also of people. It can be, I'm bad and mean and nasty. Virtually all children feel that sometimes when they get real mad or real upset about something. Also, of course, mommy can be bad, daddy can be bad. So the roles can be me bad or mommy bad or daddy bad. Or it can be, of course, me good, me happy, me sad, me angry. The next level involves putting together a couple of these social roles to form a role relationship, the simplest kind of role relationship, in which one role relates to another. So at the prior level, at the single behavioral roles, mommy may do something to the baby, but the baby doesn't really reciprocate. To have a role relationship, you have to have two agents acting together. So the child is acting like a child and the mommy is acting like a mommy, and they're doing it, interacting with each other. So now we've got Jane the mom and Johanna the child actually acting together. So in a story, the child will now be dealing with two dolls at the same time, one being the mommy, one being the child. The child may say, Mommy, I'm hungry. Can you get me some food? And then the mommy will say, of course. You like grapes, right? I'll get you some grapes. And then the child says, these are wonderful grapes, Mommy. Thank you so much. You have that kind of a real interaction. I did it in words. It doesn't have to be in words. It can just be in actions. But it has to be an interaction of two agents carrying out specific roles in relationship to each other. The father-child is, of course, another example in the family of this kind of role relationship. These first develop at its optimal level at about 3.5 to 4.5 years. And you rarely see them before 3.5. For ordinary behavior, it's later than that. Of course, this is the best that they can do under supportive conditions. This is a role relationship that kids get very confused about. Many roles in the family and in society are real complicated. Every adult knows that we occupy multiple roles at the same time, like I can be a teacher and I can be a father. But those are kind of separated most of the time. In the family, a lot of the roles are mushed together. So you've got mother-wife are overlap so much that young children can't even tell the difference between them. So for them, really, mother is all mushed in with wife, and father is all mushed in with husband. They're kind of globbed or condensed. Leads to many silly confusions on the part of the child. I mean, from the child's point of view, they're not silly, but adults think they're cute when children ask questions or tell stories. They get these things all mixed up. There's something called the Oedipus conflict. We'll talk about later in the semester. I know a lot of you have heard about it, and that involves the confusion about this, like where the child thinks that they can take over the role of the same-sex parent. Like that. So Johanna replaces her mother as the mother-wife to her father-husband. That's what the old Oedipus story was about. That's why it's called the Oedipus conflict. General, children have to deal with this triad of relationships. They have to build up representations of all three roles. That's a lot harder than just pairs. And how they relate to each other. So Jane is mother and Kurt is father to their child, Johanna. Um, The last role we're going to talk about today, that level of roles, is systems of roles, which involve an intersection, where each person is doing the several roles at the same time. Jane is wife and mother. Kurt is husband and father. This children struggle with this until they're about 6 or 7, and even then they struggle with it under low support. Under high support at 6 or 7, they begin to be able to control it quite well. Understanding that wife and mother are different, husband and father are different, Jane can be both in relation to Kurt in family relationships. So that permeates all the roles. This is when children stop being so confused about the roles. This is when children stop generally saying, "Daddy, I want to marry you," or "Mommy, I want to marry you," and they get embarrassed about having said those horrible things earlier, or denied that they would have ever said such a thing. So in general, what I tried to do today is to review how we build our minds socially, how we build them with other people, especially the people we're close to, how the mind in general is social, built out of relationships, close relationships, which we take in, internalize as agents in our own personalities. We build these up through developmental webs, focusing on roles in the family and emotional interactions in the family, and with other close relationships. The levels that we move through are systematic, moving through from single representations to mappings to systems during childhood. But how we actually understand and how we actually act at any one moment varies enormously depending upon whether somebody is doing it with us, supporting us in doing it in a global way, or actually participating in the task with us in scaffolding. In general, the big point is that we co-construct who we are. We construct our understanding of ourselves, our understanding of others, and all of our skills through close collaboration with the people that we live with, the people that we work with.